How many of you are new to mindfulness meditation? So some of you have to raise your hand again. And some of you, first time. So I want to welcome you all. This is the first day then of a five-week introductory course in mindfulness practice. And my name is Gil Fronsdal. And I have been teaching mindfulness meditation, Buddhist practice here in the Palo Alto area for about 9 years now. And I've been practicing Buddhist meditation for about more than 25 years. My early practice was in Zen Buddhism, Japanese Zen Buddhism, and I practiced at the San Francisco Zen Center and Tassajara, which some of you know, Green Gulch Farm, and I also went and practiced Zen meditation in monasteries in Japan for a year. And then after my time in Japan, I went and spent a year and a half in Southeast Asia. And the Southeast Asian Buddhist tradition is the one that has the practice of mindfulness, carries that practice. Mindfulness is sometimes called a vipassana. You'll see that word sometimes. And vipassana is probably most directly translated into English as insight. So those are three words that are almost synonymous: mindfulness, insight meditation, and vipassana. And then I continued doing this vipassana practice when I came back to America. And then I was trained by Jack Kornfield to be a Vipassana teacher myself, and I've been teaching here in this area since 1990. And I teach also at Spirit Rock, which some of you might know or might want to go to someday. Spirit Rock is a large meditation center that we've built in Marin County, where it's possible to do all kinds of classes and retreats, meditation retreats. I feel it's a privilege to be teaching you a class in mindfulness, partly because mindfulness meditation, mindfulness practice, is something which I greatly love. And it's wonderful to be able to share what I love to many people. Mindfulness is considered traditionally to be maybe this is not exactly the traditional wording of it, but kind of like the crown jewel of Buddhism. It's the the cream of Buddhism. Sometimes, because it's the crown jewel or the cream of Buddhism, it's not taught right away to people. Sometimes, traditionally in Buddhism, you have to wait a number of years, perhaps doing all kinds of preparatory practices, preparing yourself so you really be ready to do the mindfulness practice. And here in America, we don't usually do that. So we just kind of let people, you know, come off the street and do an introductory course and do the best they can with it. It's very powerful, the mindfulness practice, for those people who want to take it to its full depths. And it's very effective as a wonderful antidote to the normal kind of stresses, tensions of everyday life. And so there's a whole range of ways in which people will use the mindfulness practice. Some people will simply looking for a way to get a little bit calmer, to have a little less stress in their life, to unwind a little bit in an effective way. Some people are looking for mindfulness, looking at mindfulness as a way of developing more self-knowledge, self-understanding. The glasses of mindfulness, the ability to use our awareness to understand ourselves deeply, is very, very effective. And so self-knowledge is often a result that comes. The Buddhist purpose for mindfulness practice goes well beyond just becoming calm, well beyond just self-knowledge, to what can be called liberation or freedom. Not just simply adjusting ourselves or finding a better way of coping with life, but actually finding some kind of radical liberation, freedom, from the normal kinds of self-identity, self-limitations, self-concepts that many of us operate under most of the time. kind of the sister crown jewel. Maybe there's two crown jewels in Buddhism. One is the awakened awareness that comes with mindfulness, and the other is compassion. And the full depth of Buddhist spirituality is the unfolding of a phenomenal capacity for compassion. Many people think of Buddhism as a practice leading to enlightenment. What isn't noticed is that it's just as much a practice leading to compassionment. And most of us, I think, would be better off being, those of us who are madly in pursuit of enlightenment are probably better off pursuing compassionment. It probably helps more people out, maybe. Maybe the two aren't so separate. So what I'm trying to say here is that there's a full range of ways that a person can use mindfulness. And I'm not so concerned about how any of you want to use this practice. I'm quite content and happy if some of you simply want to use it as a way of stress reduction or self-knowledge or some better way of helping you cope a little bit with day-to-day affairs. And that's fine with me. And if some of you would like to take it much further than that, or perhaps even take it to the full depth, that's fine with me. I'd be happy to be supportive and help you out in that direction also. It doesn't, in a sense, it doesn't matter so much what your motivation is, because the basic practice, the basic instructions is actually the same. So, I'll just give you the instruction. It's a Buddhist practice. I don't really care whether you care that it's Buddhist. you can take or leave the Buddhist part as you wish. The mindfulness practice stands on its own, in its own right. There are books where there are Christians and Jews who have taken studied mindfulness in the Buddhist tradition, and left Buddhism and taking the practice with them, and now teach the mindfulness in their Christian or in their Jewish context. So the mindfulness practice, is quite free. Mindfulness practice is freer than any religion. It doesn't have any label. So as I'll use Buddhist language and refer to Buddhism as we go through the five-week course, and if you don't like that, just edit that out. It's okay with me. So mindfulness is a kind of a crown jewel of Buddhism, our ability to be aware, awareness itself. Awareness itself is something which most people don't notice very much. We're not very aware of our awareness, partly because most of us are constantly focused on what we're aware of or what we're afraid might happen or what we want to happen. Our desires, the objects of our desires, our objects of our fears, our objects of our plans and ambitions. We are we're always kind of often looking at other people. What are other people thinking about me? How do I relate to that person? What do I want for dinner? You go in the refrigerator and see what's in the refrigerator I can make dinner with, and where's the local store? And we're concerned with all these things about the world. And all the things that we can know in the world are called in Buddhism the objects of awareness. And we often don't notice that in order to be aware of something, there has to be awareness. It's kind of maybe an obvious thing to say, but it's not so obvious that we remember that so often. And Buddhism focuses very much on this wonderful ability we have of awareness itself. So in a sense, it focuses on developing a capacity we have that has nothing to do inherently with the objects of the world. But as this capacity of awareness that is a container for everything becomes stronger and stronger for us, as our ability to be more and more attentive, the awareness itself becomes this wonderful kind of equanimous capacity that can hold everything, no matter what happens to us, without cringing, without getting afraid, without anger or hate, or without confusion, or without desire and lust and clinging and ambition and greed, without being neurotic or, all the kind of anxious ways in which, are problematic for us. It's possible to have an awareness that's larger than that. So the awareness kind of provides a kind of ease in our life that's quite beautiful. So we like in Buddhism to point to this wonderful capacity of awareness because we tend to overlook it. And as we recognize more this wonderful thing of awareness, you'll find that it makes life a lot easier. So mindfulness is something very, very simple. We all have it. It's not an Asian thing. You know, it's not like an Indian thing that the Buddha invented. All human beings have awareness. And what we're trying to do in mindfulness is simply to strengthen this inherent ability that we all have. So that awareness, mindfulness, presence is more of a regular occurrence for our life rather than something that happens in exceptional situations. And most of you will think, well, I'm aware, maybe, you know, but if you really look at your life, you'll find probably that a large proportion of your day is spent not being so aware in any kind of deep way, any clear way. When we're lost in the future, planning, or is lost in remembering, or rehearsing conversations we're going to have, or that we had in the past, we're not really so present because we get pulled into that mental world of thoughts and recollections and planning. And sometimes we cannot even know what's going on. The common English word for this is preoccupation. We're preoccupied and we don't really know what's going on. And the mindfulness practice is a practice that goes directly against or tries to lessen the forces of preoccupation in order to strengthen the forces of real presence and really be present for our life. Most of us know what it's like to be talking to someone, to a friend or someone, and the person's not really present for us. You know, it's kind of like a drag, right? Or you shake hands with someone and they're not really, the hands, you know, already limp and they're talking to someone else. They're not really present. And we know what it's like when someone's really present for us. They're really listening to us, they're hearing us, they're present, they give us a firm handshake or whatever. So we see it a lot in others. We can also have this capacity in ourselves to either not be present fully for what's happening or for ourselves, or we can develop a capacity to really be present on an ongoing basis and not get pulled into the various distractions or preoccupations of the mind. So mindfulness practice is simply trying to develop this wonderful capacity to be present more often, more continuously throughout the day. Now I use the word mindfulness practice as carefully, intentionally, rather than mindfulness meditation. Because many of you might have come here today thinking that this is a 5-week introductory course in meditation practice. And it'll certainly be that. But mindfulness is not limited to simply sitting in meditation posture, something you do in meditation, but rather is a skill, it's a capacity of being that is developed and used or applied, awoken, in all aspects of our life. And actually, it's a very artificial divide, separation, to separate formal meditation practice from everyday life. So you'll, as I talk in these 5 weeks about mindfulness, you'll see that it's not, maybe not so obvious that I'm, you know, when I'm talking about mindfulness in daily life and when I'm talking about it in meditation, because I'll kind of slide back and forth. And that's because in my mind there is no absolute difference between the two. It's the same mind, the same heart in both situations, and the same kind of phenomena of the mind occur. So I hope that this class teaches you not only some basic instructions in meditation practice, but also some wonderful tools for daily life practice also. So I call it mindfulness practice. Even if we're not particularly even if we don't recognize ourselves as being distracted a lot or preoccupied a lot, I think that many people will find, as they do a meditation practice or a mindfulness practice, that their life starts becoming more multidimensional. And what we recognize often is how much we live kind of in a one-dimensional world. So, for example, if we're constantly preoccupied in our mental, with our mental life, with our cognitive life, with our thoughts and concerns and ideas in our head, and it's very easy to do that in a busy life. The busier the life is, and the more things we're trying to fit in and do, the more likely we are not to be present, more likely we are to get swept up in a lot of mental preoccupation. To be mentally preoccupied all the time is to live one-dimensionally. And you might not even, a person might not even know they're living one-dimensionally in kind of a mental preoccupied world until they do something like meditation that shows them that there's, awakens in them a much larger capacity of being alive than simply mentally cognating. Some people are one-dimensional just with their emotions, their feelings. And the feelings are the be-all and end-all, and they interpret and see and everything through the filter of their emotions. The idea of mindfulness is to awaken the capacity to be open to the full range of our humanity. And that's why I call it to become multidimensional. And some of you will probably find, as you do this practice, you find kind of a greater intimacy or more fullness of being as all the different parts of who we are come into balance and come into play equally, rather than having one side of our life more predominating than others. We want our physical life, our bodily life, our emotional life, our cognitive life to all work together harmoniously and in balance, not that any one of them to be the main preoccupation. So so it's not so easy to develop our attention, even though it's something we all have, to strengthen it. So one of the most useful places kind of to get mindfulness with training wheels, if we may say, is informal meditation practice. It's a lot easier to develop the attention when we can, when we really sit still, have our eyes closed, and don't have to do a lot with our body, but can just sit still. And so we often start there in formal meditation practice. And once we get the hang of how to develop mindfulness, how to be more present, we discover some of the aspects of what the awareness actually is. Then it kind of either spills over by osmosis in daily life, or we become very interested in how to bring that into our daily life and to awaken our daily life also. So it starts with a meditation practice. And so what will happen today is I'll give you some basic instruction in mindfulness of the posture, how to take good posture in meditation, and then do some very basic instructions on mindfulness of breathing, which is the heart of the practice. And then in the next few weeks, I'll expand the instructions. So next week, we'll talk about mindfulness of the body, how to include the rest of our bodily experiences. All the various experiences of the body that can occur to us, how to include those as part of the meditation practice. The week after that, I'll talk about mindfulness of emotions, how to include the emotions in a balanced way as part of the meditation practice. The fourth week, I'll talk about mindfulness of thoughts, our cognitive world. Many people think that thoughts are the enemy of meditation, and it's not the case at all, but rather we have to learn a wise way of how to include them within the scope of mindfulness. And then the fifth week, I'll talk about more about the integration of the practice into daily life. And that'll be the 5 weeks. If you miss a week, or you know you have to miss a week, these talks are being taped. And also previous introductory courses have been taped. And you can talk to Allison, who's sitting right here, and she can either provide you or sell you, you know, whatever you might be missing. The class is offered on a donation basis, and the main reason for that, there's two important reasons for that. One is simply that it's the Buddhist tradition, in our tradition, to offer the teachings and the opportunities to practice freely, so it's available to anybody at all, regardless of costs and means. So it's part of the tradition, but also I think that more importantly, when there's a kind of a feeling of monetary exchange, that the kind of value we put on a spiritual practice becomes maybe a little bit skewed or funny, or potentially could be that way. And so it just kind of part of the spirit of Buddhist practice is this open generosity, and so we do that, we offer the practice in that spirit. But as the tradition needs to be supported, we have two donation baskets out in the hallway, and one of them is labeled rent and one of them is labeled teacher, and we have to pay for the rent of this room. We pay the Quakers for the use. And the only way we can pay for that is if people make donations for the rent. And if everyone here put in a dollar for each time they come, that would more than cover our rent and some of other expenses we have in, for our sitting group. And that would be great. If the other one is labeled teacher, and my livelihood, my life, my career, my vocation, or whatever you want to call it, is being a meditation teacher. 95% or so of my livelihood comes from donations I receive for teaching. So it's only possible for me to continue doing this kind of work if I receive donations. And you don't have to do it. It's up to you whether you feel inspired, would like to do it. But so that's what the baskets out in the hallway are. You can make anonymous donations if you want. It's basically anonymous if you put money in there. In all the years I've been doing this, I've never given a suggested amount to donate. And I thought I'd try it out once today. Kind of see what that feels like. And the kind of, when people pay for this kind of course, places where they do charge, it's usually $10 a class or $50 for a 5-week introductory course. So I'd like to suggest that. And you can do with that suggestion whatever you want. And you can tell me at the end of the course what you thought of it. My saying that. So, meditation practice. It's very important in doing a meditation practice to have a good posture when you sit. And what a good posture is depends on each individual person. We all have different bodies with different capacities. So you have to listen to posture instruction and figure out, you know, how to interpret it for your particular body. We want to have some expression of alertness when we do a meditation posture. Some people associate meditation only with getting calm. And so they think they should just take the most relaxed posture they can get into, you know, and probably, you know, doing it in a really, really soft down bed, laying down. It's probably the most ideal way to meditate, you know, because you're really relaxed. Or slouching, you know, it's really relaxed, so that's the way it should be done. Paradoxically, ironically, you can't actually relax deeply. Or the full capacity for relaxation isn't available to you if you don't have a good posture. If you don't have a kind of some posture that also expresses some alertness in the posture. So there's a balance between relaxation in the meditation posture and alertness that needs to be there. If you're sitting on the floor, which is a traditional way of sitting, the best thing to do is if you sit on some kind of cushion, so you're elevated, and your knees are kind of then angled down to the floor. And it isn't that this is so much, you know, in some mystical yogic posture. It's just very helpful to have a balanced, stable posture that holds your torso upright for a while. And one of the most stable postures we can have is a triangle with our knees and our butt. Triangles are very stable. It feels a little bit more stable than sitting on a chair. So that's kind of the basic pragmatic reason for sitting on the floor. So we want to sit on a cushion. And the traditional way is to sit on round cushions like this, called zafus. And the way that the zafus are usually traditionally meant to be sat on is we sit on the front third of the cushion. And now it's flat down on top of it. And the reason for that is if you sit in the front third, you're kind of sitting on the slope of the cushion. And so the cushion actually tilts your pelvis forward slightly. And as the pelvis gets tipped forward slightly, it's easier to get the knees down to the floor. And it's nice to have the knees on the floor because then you're really stable if you can do that. And in having the knee sitting cross-legged, I recommend actually not crossing the legs, actually, but sitting kind of Taylor style or Burmese style with one leg in front of the other. I don't know if you can see the way I'm sitting, but both of the forelegs are on the ground, one in front of the other. That puts much less strain on the body and the legs than sitting half lotus or full lotus. If you can't get your knees down, you can try sitting higher. The higher you sit, the more easier it is to get your knees down. Or you can prop up your knees. You can get some kind of cushions and sit up and then put something underneath your knees. Or if one of your knees is up, put something up underneath one of your knees so it's held up and supported. There are alternative ways of sitting on the floor. One is to sit on your knees. You can take this round cushion and put it upright and put it between your knee, your ankles, and then sit down on it. And you're sitting higher that way, and some people find that's easier than sitting cross-legged. And this is a fine way of sitting. It's not as balanced or stable, but it works pretty well. And some people like to sit on benches like this, and the bench takes the weight, but you're kind of sitting on top of you're sitting below, maybe a little bit lower than on a cushion, and you put the bench over your ankles and sit down like this. And some people, this works well. And there are various kinds of cushions to sit on. There's also these, which is crescent moon cushions, which some people like to sit on. They kind of spread your weight a little bit differently than these, and so some people find these more comfortable to sit on. Allison sells these kinds of paraphernalia, and I believe she's probably one of the cheapest places in the peninsula for this, so if you're interested in actually getting your own, you can talk to Allison. So the idea is to sit So if you're sitting on the floor, you want to sit in a stable way. And all this is part in service of being able to hold your back straight. It's very useful to have a straight back when you meditate. And what that means is that it's not actually straight. There's actually the normal curve in the lower part of the back is left intact, which means you don't want your lower back to be flat or caving out. You want actually to be swayed in a little bit, but not too much, just maybe slightly more than the normal curve. And one of the reasons, there's a number of reasons for that. One is that's the healthiest way for your back. It's easier to sit still for a long time if you have a good back posture, as many people know now. And also it's more effortless to hold the rest of the torso upright if the lower back is swayed in a little bit. So by sitting up on the cushion, having your knees down, it's easier to have a little sway in your lower back. If you're sitting on a chair, you can get the same effect by having your knees lower than your hips. If your knees are higher than the hips on the chair, then you'll more likely kind of cave out your lower back and have all kinds of back problems in the long term. So, and then usually sitting on the chair, it's best to have, it's usually suggested you have your feet parallel to each other, legs parallel to each other, and knees at a right angle. Though some people like to have their knees out and feel that's more secure, their legs out. But the idea is your knees have a right angle. You're not leaning forward, and you're not crossing the legs when you're sitting in a chair. It's best, if you can do it, not to use the backrest when you sit in the chair. Some people need to use a backrest, but part of what we're developing, at least in Buddhist mindfulness training, is an ability to be self-reliant. And there's a wonderful correlation between our inner psychological life and our physical posture, so that it's easier to develop an inner self-reliance if the body itself is self-reliant, not being supported by anything. So if you can sit away from the backrest, that's really the best. If you need to use a backrest, it's best to, if you can do it, only support the lower back. Have really strong, firm support in the lower back and have the rest of the back self-supporting. If you need to have your whole back being supported by the backrest, that's fine, if that's what needs to happen. Some people will also do the meditation lying down on their back if that's the only thing that they're able to do because of a back injury or something. So you want to have a straight spine. An interesting little exercise you can do, especially on the floor, I think you can do it in the chair too, is you can take your hands on either side of your hips on the floor, push yourself almost off the cushion or off the chair. Let your chest come up and out. Not forcing it out, but just let it come out. And then as you release your hands, let your shoulders relax backwards. And if you do that, you might find yourself sitting in a straight, nice, aligned posture with your shoulders feeling limited, like they're hanging in a relaxed way. As you sit this way, you want to gently tuck your chin in slightly. And in our tradition, we keep our eyes closed. It means gently closing the eyes, letting the mouth be closed, resting the tongue against the roof of the mouth. The hands can be in any posture that seems symmetrical. Both hands are doing the same thing. So you can either have your hands on your lap or on your thighs, on your knees, or you can have your hands together, which is more traditional in Buddhism. Both hands together, kind of one holding the other. And sometimes people like to have it resting on their ankle or the heel, and sometimes they like holding it up higher. Sometimes if you have your hands resting on your heel, on your ankle, then depending on your proportional length of your arms and your back and your torso, you might be pulling your shoulders forward, and it might cause some strain in your neck and your shoulders. And then getting some kind of a towel or another cushion and putting it on your heel so your hands can be held higher can take some of the strain off the shoulders, and that can be helpful. Does that make sense? Anyone have any questions about posture at this point? Anything you want to ask? Yes?
Yes, I had a severe auto accident in 95, and I can't sit up for long periods of time. So you mentioned lying down in a recliner, that sort of thing, would be okay?
If you need to, I think it's probably better when you're lying down to lie on a flat surface. So I don't know if the recliner is flat, but like to lay on the floor. Partly, a floor is being a little bit hard. It shouldn't be too hard. But if it's a little bit harder than recliner, perhaps it's more conducive to staying alert. If it's just too soft, the recliner, then maybe you lose some of that alertness. The usual way is to lay on. There's a couple of different ways of laying on the floor, but the usual way that people do is to lay on their back. And if they can, have the knees up, so the feet are up close to the butt, kind of somewhat, so bent. Partly because that takes a little bit of effort. And so that little bit of effort that goes into keeping the legs up helps reinforce the alertness. You also can do standing meditation. That's another option. There are four classic postures called the four dignities that the Buddha taught. There's a sitting posture for meditation, there's a lying down posture, there's standing posture, and there's walking posture, walking. And you can do mindfulness meditation in all four of those postures. So some people can't do any kind of sitting, and lying down doesn't work, and they do standing. I knew a man who stood for years in his meditation practice. So what I'd like to do now is to do the next bit of instructions on the breath as a guided meditation. But we've been sitting here for a while. Maybe some of you aren't used to it. So why don't you just stand for about 30 seconds, stretch if you'd like. This practice is, as I said earlier, has a lot to do with developing the capacity to be aware, to be present in the present for things as they are happening. That's enough just to develop that. However, there is an attitude that is often recommended that you try to have in relationship to your practice or to yourself. And that is an attitude of acceptance or allowance. What that means is an attitude which is the opposite of always being critical, judgmental, being critical of whatever you notice about yourself as you do the practice, but rather having some kind of a sense of love or loving kindness for oneself and what happens, to be phenomenally patient and gentle with oneself, not to use the meditation practice as another excuse to decide that you're a terrible person or a bad person or you've done something wrong, or you're told this wonderful meditation practice of meditating on your breath, and you find that you're able to stay with three breaths, and they say, oh, now I'm a failure as a meditator also. And then you're kind of critical and down on yourself. The spirit of mindfulness practice is one of unconditional acceptance, allowing ourselves to be who we are. And in that spirit of that kind of acceptance, that's one of the best kind of fields in which deeper spiritual practice can flower, can grow. So take a good, comfortable, alert posture, letting your back be straight. And softly close your eyes. And then it's useful at the beginning of a period of meditation to take a few, two or three deep breaths. And then as you breathe out, to relax the body. Relax the mind. And then after a few deep breaths, to let your breathing return to normal. Let your breath be whatever way it wants to be. There's no right or wrong way to breathe for mindfulness practice. Then as you're sitting here, become aware of your body's experience of breathing. How does your body itself feel when it's breathing? What happens in your body that lets you know that you're breathing? The movement of the diaphragm or the chest, the belly. Become aware of what it feels like to breathe. Become aware of your breathing. And if you have a hard time finding your breathing, the sensations of the body, you can place your hand on your stomach, and perhaps you can feel the rising and falling of the abdomen as you breathe. The sensations of the body breathing are always occurring in the present moment. And in that, we want to develop our ability to stay in the present moment. The breath is one of the great places to develop that capacity. If you are staying with your breathing, with the in-breaths and the out-breaths, you're staying in the present moment. See if you can let yourself rest in those sensations of the body connected to breathing. Feeling your body breathing in, feeling your body breathing out. Inevitably, your mind will get caught up again in its thoughts. When you notice that that's happened, with acceptance, with gentleness, begin again to become aware of your breathing. Letting yourself rest with the experience of breathing. Kind of like the breath is like the waves of the ocean going up and down, and awareness is the cork that floats on the surface. It moves up and down with the breath, with the waves. Letting go of your thoughts and concerns. Letting yourself receive the breath as intimately as you can. And there's a way of using your thoughts to help you stay present. And that is to very, very softly to label or name the in-breath as in, the out-breath as out. Or if you're experiencing the rising and falling of the chest or the belly, to just simply name it rising and falling. Using those very, very subtle thought thought labels, to stay present, to guide you to the breath, rather than have your random thoughts creep in and pull you away. If there is one place in your body where you feel the breath the most strongly, perhaps the nostrils where the air goes in, or perhaps the chest rising and falling, or the diaphragm or the belly rising and falling, if there's one place that it's most clear, you can make the practice simpler, simplest, by resting your attention in that one place. Simply experiencing the being with the body's experience of breathing in that one place. Not trying to accomplish anything, not trying to change anything, except to be as continuously as you can, resting in the experience of breathing. When you sit in meditation, there's nothing which is wrong with you. In meditation, you can accept yourself as you are, allow yourself to be as you are, and then in the midst of that, center yourself on the experience of breathing. Not excluding everything else, but rather letting the experience of breathing be at the center where you're resting. Letting the focus be on the breathing. And then when it's time to finish a period of meditation, before opening your eyes, it's nice to take once again one or two deep breaths, connecting into your body. And then when you're ready, opening your eyes. So as I said at the beginning, the attitude or spirit of mindfulness practice that's helpful to have, not always possible to have, but it's helpful to have, is one of acceptance, of allowing ourselves to be as we are. And then the experience of many people is actually an experience of non-acceptance. And this is one of the reasons why there's a lot of stress. We have a lot of stress and a lot of suffering in our lives, is because of the kind of struggle we have with ourselves and with life by not accepting the way things are. Now, of course, some things shouldn't be accepted. They're unacceptable, you know, and Buddhist practice is not about, the, you know, ignoring injustice, for example. But there's all kinds of things which we're fighting against, we're resisting, we hate, we dislike, or we want things to be different. We demand them to be different. Things which are part of nature, part of life. The resistance, the animosity, the inner war that many people have is not very healthy and useful. And a lot of what we're learning in mindfulness is a kind of acceptance that allows us to see ourselves and see the present situation clearly. If we're struggling with resentment, with aversion, with desire, with wanting, with ambition, with preoccupation, with concerns about the past or the future, it's very hard to actually see clearly ourselves or what's happening in the present moment. Once we can see what's clearly what's happening in the present, then it allows us to act or choose wisely how we want to respond. Another way of saying this is, the kind of acceptance we're looking for in Buddhist practice is one where we're not in a where we're not acting in the world out of our habitual reactions. We're not kind of on automatic pilot, automatically reacting to whatever's happening to us. Our anger doesn't automatically get triggered and get us to kind of spit out some terrible thing to a neighbor or a friend. Or, you know, if we're walking down the street and we see an ice cream parlor, and the next thing you know, you're walking down the street holding an ice cream cone, you know, you've lost some of your mindfulness there. You've maybe acted automatically, automatic pilot. The acceptance, the kind of acceptance I'm talking about, interrupts the automatic reactive behavior that gets us into so much trouble and allows us to see ourselves in the situation more clearly. And then we can choose how to wisely respond rather than simply react. So acceptance is a very important part of this. And because non-acceptance is such a huge part of most people's lives, it's actually a phenomenally radical thing to do, to accept ourselves, to accept our present situation, not to struggle against it or fight it or want it to be different. And it's phenomenally relaxing to do that. And we begin to unwind all the different forces of stress that arise out of our non-acceptance. One of the common experiences people have when they start doing meditation practice, if you're really a beginner at this, is to discover that the mind is out of control. And maybe some of you discovered this evening. And for some people it's a shock, because some people are always so busy with themselves and their life that they don't really know what's going on in their mind until they actually stop, close their eyes, and pay attention. And sometimes the experience of a very busy mind, out of control, is called in Buddhism the monkey mind. And the idea being, it's kind of like a monkey that's out of control, swinging from one branch to the other in the forest, never satisfied with any branch. So the mind's constantly running after this thing and that thing and just kind of, you know, spinning around like a crazy monkey, the monkey mind. Some people, when they notice how busy their mind is, how much chatter there is, idle chatter or whatever kind of chatter is going on, and how it seems to have tremendous power over us, we keep getting pulled into it, some people will get discouraged by that. Say, oh, I can't meditate, my mind is too crazy. Rather, you should take heart and realize that you've now attained the first stage of meditation. You're making progress. You've understood something about yourself. You understood the mind is out of control. Before that, your mind was out of control, but you didn't know it. So you're making progress. So just be patient, and I'm quite serious about this. That's actually useful. It's actually very healthy to recognize very clearly where we're at and start where we're at. And by starting where we're at and accepting where we're at, then in the middle of that, just breathing mindfully, not using the breath as a way of pushing away who we are or trying to force ourselves to be different or resisting who we are, but rather starting with the idea, I'm sitting here to be myself, and in the midst of who I am, if I'm depressed or angry or happy or sad or whatever it's going on right now, let me just accept that for now, and in the midst of that, let me just breathe mindfully and see what happens. Make sense? So what was a few of your experiences of sitting in this for these 15-20 minutes and meditating? Do you have any questions about it at this point? Did you find it difficult or easy? Or yes?
I find that when I focus on my breath, that my breath is not my normal breath. I can just, when I focus on it, I tend to control it, and I'm not sure. It doesn't seem right.
Right. It's common enough for people, for some people, to have the experience of controlling the breathing. Almost anything that becomes our conscious focus, conscious object of awareness, we feel like we have to control or, you know, manipulate or hold at bay or do something with. And the beautiful thing about mindfulness practice is that we're not trying to change ourselves so much in the practice itself as become aware. What we're trying to do is develop our awareness. And we're developing awareness by paying attention to what's actually happening. And what's actually happening for you is your breath is being controlled. So your job in meditation is to become a world-class expert at what it feels like to have a controlled breath. That's all. It's not a problem. And if you have that attitude also, then with time, you'll just relax and it won't be an issue. Make sense? So we often have this idea that certain kinds of breathing are better than other kinds. Controlled breath is not where it's at. So I'm doing it wrong. Just you're breathing whatever way you are, and then you want to be mindful of what that's like. Eventually what you'll find, and what some people maybe find, is the breath is this marvelous bridge between different aspects of our life. It's a bridge between the conscious and unconscious processes in our body. And it's possible to control the breath, and it's possible not to control it and have it go along. And it's a marvelous thing to discover the ability to be with some activity of the body that's not under conscious control. And because it's an activity that's not constantly controlling, it's possible to let the mind rest in a way that's not if we're always involved in controlling it. But don't be in a hurry to get to that place. It's really what you're trying to do is develop your awareness of the kind of breath you have.
I find it kind of, the breathing's kind of hypnotic. You know, and so I'll find myself like drifting off, you know, but I think that I drift off because it's hard to be aware, you know, like it's almost like I want to block that out and just kind of go into not being aware of anything and just kind of relaxing that way. So
uh-huh.
I find it, you know, hard to really stay aware the whole time.
So a few things about that. One is that the breath is, for many people, a calming subject of meditation. It tends to bring some calm. But it's possible sometimes to get too calm in meditation. And we need to actually have a balance of energy and relaxation. Some people are kind of hanging on or leaning into their relaxing. That's what they want. They're desperate for, please, any relaxation at all. And so they're kind of leaning into that and or kind of savoring it or, you know. And if you do it too much, then the whole system will begin becoming tired. And as you become tired and too calm, and there's not that alertness there, the wandering mind will take you away. So if you find yourself, you have to be aware of this kind of this balance between making some effort and having relaxation be present. So you might take a while for you to find that balance. For you right now, making the effort to be mindful might be stressful or not relaxing. So you might have to let yourself go in the relaxing direction and then pull yourself back a little bit to try to find the balance. Some people will find that being mindful, it isn't so much that it requires a lot of effort, but rather, and don't be afraid of effort. Effort is fine. And initially, if the mind is really distracted, it does take some effort to come back and try to be present. And with time, it becomes easier and easier. It becomes like a muscle. You know, if you go down to the gym and you've never been to the gym to work out, you have to make some effort to lift, you know, the 2-pound weights. But after you lift 2-pound weights for a few months, it's no problem at all, right? But you have to make the effort to do it, right? So don't be afraid of effort, but see if you can find the balance between effort and relaxation. The other thing is that the other reason why some people would rather not be mindful is that when we're present for our inner life, some of our inner life is not very comfortable. And so, for example, we're troubled by what we find out about ourselves. We're surprised that there's a lot of anger, surprised that there's a lot of rage, or surprised that there's a lot of painful memories that we forgot about or whatever. And so some people would rather not be present. And one of the reasons for distraction, why it's such a powerful pull for some people, is that it's so uncomfortable to be present for how you really are in life that you take a vacation or you kind of hide, escape into the distraction. Thinking about the future all the time is a lot more comfortable than being with your own feelings. So part of mindfulness practice is gently, with loving kindness and compassion, beginning to learn the capacity to learn how to be present for oneself and for what is difficult inside of oneself. And with time, it becomes easier and easier. And the beautiful thing is that as we make space in our present awareness for all the different conflicted and difficult things inside of us, they begin to process themselves or heal themselves. If we stay distracted, these inner conflicts can't heal themselves, can't be healed. You have to bring some awareness to them. It's kind of like mindfulness is sometimes likened to a light. And when we bring our mindfulness to something, it's like bringing light to it. And our inner life is like a greenhouse that's just ready to flower and bloom and grow if it gets light. And so if you bring your light, then wonderful things begin happening. But if you keep the inner life, you keep the greenhouse light off, and it's always in the dark, then rather than growing these beautiful plants, it's the molds and the rats and everything that just thrive. And this is a principle of the inner life, that that awareness tends to bring healing and tends to support the beautiful qualities of inner life, and unawareness tends to support the painful, conflicted and unwholesome, unhealthy states of the inner life. So the idea is mindfulness is to learn the ability to not be afraid or not recoil from some of the difficult things we might occasionally discover about ourselves, but rather learn to go through it and into it and through it, and by going through it, discovering some wonderful treasure that we all have that lies in the midst of the difficulty. Yes?
I'm not sure, maybe just what you said is the answer, but I'm not sure how in every situation mindfulness really heals the inner conflict. If the inner conflict has to do with things that are completely beyond your control, that are affecting your inner peace, I'm not sure how the mindfulness helps that, other than making you notice the pain more.
If you can give an example, that would be helpful.
A recent example, maybe you hear all this news about Littleton and about Kosovo, and it makes you think of the darker nature of some human beings, the darker side of human beings, something you don't have any control over. You have control over your own,
right?
Maybe yourself, and you can be aware whether you have a dark side or not.
Right.
But the other's dark side, you have no control over that.
Right.
And you're still very much bothered by it, and it affects your inner peace.
Right.
I'm not sure how the mindfulness helps with that.
We can become aware of what the button is being pushed inside of us. So, I mean, there are terrible things in the world which we should feel a little bit uncomfortable with, a little bit kind of like things are a little bit wrong here, and we should feel, you know, we shouldn't be go around, we shouldn't, you know, get the news about the massacre at Columbine High School and go around smiling. There'd be something terribly wrong with a person if they did that. So we should feel a little bit, we should feel bad. I mean, it's okay to feel bad when terrible things happen. But if that discomfort triggers our fear, or triggers our fear of ourselves, or fear of our desire to kind of, or it resonates with some deep kind of trauma that we have in ourselves, then the sense of distress might be much greater than what's normal in that situation. And then in bringing awareness and recognizing the buttons, recognizing what it resonates with, recognizing our attitudes, begins creating some space where we're not caught up in those attitudes. And we're not caught up in those attitudes, the attitudes can begin to unravel, dissolve, find their proper place. Does that make sense?
It makes sense when you hear it, but practically, I mean, there are a few things I've been aware of for a long time, but the awareness has not done the slightest help in getting over them.
Well, maybe you're not supposed to get over them. I don't know what the issues are, but take the mindfulness practice and test it. And if it doesn't work in all places, you know, maybe it's not supposed to work everywhere. It's not supposed to be the cure-all for everything. You know, use it for what it's good for, and you'll be surprised that it's good for a lot more than you realize. Yes?
So if you are getting in touch with your self.
Yes.
And you see things that you don't like very much, but yet you want to stay with it because you want to just find out what's
right.
Going on inside you. Is that getting distracted? Are you supposed to push
that? It's a good question. I think that as the 5 weeks unfold, you'll get more. I'll get more instructions of how to talk about that. So for example, if it's emotional, on the third week we'll talk about emotions. If it has to do more with the world of thoughts and ideas and memories, we'll talk about the fourth week. So for now, for right now, the instructions is don't fight or resist anything. Let it be there. But bring your attention and bring the center of your attention to the breath itself. Let the breath be at the center and let this other stuff just kind of be on the side there. You can be aware of it. Don't focus or think about it particularly. Just let it be there. Don't fight it. And just stay on your breath. Or breathe into it. If it's really difficult to stay with the breath because it's so compelling to other things, then stay with the breath but breathe into the difficulty, whether it's physical difficulty or emotional, whatever. But right now, we're the first week, just stay with the breath the best you can. Sorry?
Would also music be a distraction?
Oh.
They have all this, you know, yoga, meditation type of
thing. I recommend that you don't use any props for your meditation practice. You don't use anything like a tape or music, because what those tend to do is do the work for you or help relax you for you. And what we're trying to do in mindfulness is simply not try to get someplace where we're not, but actually cultivate the ability, the self-reliant ability, to be really honest where we actually are right now. And if you're relying on this prop, on this crutch, it's actually you're learning some very... It might be, you know, if you've never meditated before, you might try for a few days to use a tape to kind of get you along, but you don't want to make a habit of it. So in terms of doing this kind of 5-week course and continuing a practice like this, it's best to if you meditate it every day. So the homework assignment for all of you is to figure out some time each day that you can spend at least 15 minutes doing this meditation practice. And for the first week, it's primarily the way I talked about, using the breath. And the more you can become familiar and kind of rest gently with your breathing this first week, the easier it will be to understand the instructions next week. And the more you follow the instructions the next week, the easier it is to follow the instructions for emotions. The more you understand how to be with your emotions, the easier it is to learn how to be with thoughts. It's wonderful that way. Start with 15 minutes a day. Most people find it's nice to do it if it's one of the first things you do when you get up in the morning, before you get busy and get involved with a lot of different activities and the phone rings or whatever. Early morning is a quiet time, usually. And do it in a situation, a place where you're not least likely to be disturbed. Some people find it's very useful to choose a place in your house that's your meditation place, maybe a corner of your bedroom or something, and nothing else happens there except for meditation. Because then when you go there, you have those associations with that place. And that can help you kind of, you know, be more present and not kind of other associations. You know, if you sit to meditate in front of the refrigerator, it might be a little bit harder to be present. So you have different associations there. It's useful to wear loose clothes when you meditate. Some people unplug the phone or turn the ringer down or something when they meditate. Some people will sit when they get home from work. Some people before they go to sleep. Some people all of the above. But start with at least 15 minutes of meditation. And then as we continue this 5-week course, each week add 5 minutes until you get to 30 minutes. And then kind of keep it there, and then after 5 or 6 weeks of doing this, if half an hour is just too difficult in the kind of busy life you have, then you can cut it back to 15 or 20. Or if it's going well for you, then you can increase to maybe 45 minutes, depending on what you want to do with the meditation. I generally sit at home for 45 minutes, and. I think if you, that's a whole subject in itself. Some people wonder about how they keep time, how to know when 15 minutes is over, because especially since after 6 minutes it seems like 2 hours, and you're looking and then you're so disappointed, it's been 6 minutes. Or some people have the opposite experience, they're sitting there and it's like 15 minutes and it should seem like 30 seconds, I could go on forever. There's all kinds of ways of getting. You can use a kitchen timer, hopefully one that doesn't click tick all the time. Just set it for 15 minutes or however long you're sitting. The other way, some people will actually tape record 15 minutes of silence, and then the end of it ring a bell, and then they have their meditation tape and they just stuck it in the tape recorder and. Sit down to meditate, and the silence is, whirls away. and then ding, and the time is up. Anything else anyone wants to ask? Yes?
What about physical discomfort?
That's next week. Don't. You're not supposed to have any until next week. So if you need to move until next week, you can move your posture. You can also do what I said here. If it's really distracting you, if it's just kind of in the periphery, and you can stay with your breath, just stay with your breath. But if it's really difficult and pulling you into itself, then you can breathe into it, or let the breath kind of hold the physical discomfort. And sometimes that can make it manageable to the end of the time. And then next week we'll talk more about physical experience. And then, Anything else? Does it seem all clear enough? Simple enough? The idea is to keep it simple. The idea is to be accepting and compassionate. It's 51% important.
Sometimes I find that I am more distracted with my eyes closed and also wondering whether my contacts are going to be getting dry now, and that's a distraction. So, how important?
There are some Buddhist traditions where they teach the meditation with the eyes open. And certainly, you can do it with the eyes open. There's nothing inherently more important about keeping the eyes closed. So you can keep them open if you like. The usual way with the eyes open is to have them open at 45 degrees to the floor, half open, and not really focusing on anything, but kind of just a loose focus, like you imagine you're looking at a mountain far in the distance. However, in our tradition, we recommend keeping the eyes closed. One reason is that's what everyone else is doing, so we have the shared experience. But also, it seems that for most people, that as the concentration gets stronger, it's easier to really kind of be in our inner experience, in our physical embodied experience, when the eyes are closed. What we're trying to do is really feel, a lot of what mindfulness is about is kind of being embodied, feeling our body, being in our body. And it's easier to do with the eyes closed. It's kind of like, you know, maybe this is not the best example, but, you know, if you're in this passionate kiss with your lover, and you kind of open your eyes and you find, you know, kind of sneak a little look, and you notice their eyes are wide open staring at you. You know, you kind of begin kind of distrusting what's going on, right? There's something about, you know, when you're in this passionate kiss, you close your eyes, it's kind of like you're much more there for it, right? Or if you're really kind of trying to remember something, sometimes you close your eyes, you know, or you know. So there's a kind of intimacy that can happen with the eyes closed that's really wonderful. And so you might find it a little bit more distracting, but then you work with that distraction. Rather than thinking of your distractions as a problem exactly, the overcoming the distractions is exactly what you need. You need the distractions. The distractions are like the two pound weight, right? The 10 pound weight. You need the distractions to develop the strength of your muscle of mindfulness. So rather than fighting, saying, oh, my distractions are terrible, you don't exactly welcome them either, but when they occur, you say, okay, this is what I'm trying to become stronger than. So I hope this has made sense for you. I hope you will try it. And next week, after you've tried it for a week, you can maybe have some interesting reports. Maybe you can have some questions about it. And we'll just go along, and I think as we talk more, the other instructions, you'll become more obviously clear how this is useful in daily life. And to give you just a little bit of a suggestion for daily life, start becoming aware of your breathing in the midst of your daily life activities, a little bit. For example, if you're standing in line at a store or a bank or somewhere, take a few moments to pay attention to your breath, or you're standing waiting for a light, red light to turn green. Start paying attention to your breath, and you'll find that by being with your breath, the breath will teach you a lot about what's going on with you. It might be the first indication that you're really stressed or tense. And also, the more you can breathe consciously, letting the breath be relaxed and conscious, the more it lubricates our day. Because when we're stressed or preoccupied or fixated or upset about something, we almost always express that in the way we breathe. We breathe more shallowly, our chest gets taut or tense. And if we bring our conscious awareness to the breathing and the breathing becomes relaxed again, it's very hard to keep frozen or keep stuck in our emotions or feelings or thoughts of what's going on. So I call it a lubricant because it keeps things kind of lubricated and flowing rather than getting stuck. So you might experiment just in daily life, just beginning to become aware of your breathing in different situations. It's a very fascinating study. So with that, I'm going to thank you all. And if you have any other questions, please come up and ask me. And I wish you all a wonderful week with your breath. And the last thing is I want to say is that some of you have been here, been coming to our sittings here for some time, and you have some sense approximately of what we do with rearranging the room, bringing the chairs back out. Every week we need help with the chairs. So for tonight, if those people who kind of know the scene a little bit could help with the chairs, that would be greatly appreciated. Thank you.